Bibles, please, to the 23rd chapter of the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 23, verse 1. Hear now God's holy word. Thou shalt not raise a false report. Put not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. Neither shalt thou speak in a cause to decline after many to wrest judgment. Neither shalt thou countenance a poor man in his cause. If thou meet thine enemy's ox or his ass going astray, thou shalt surely bring it back to him again. If thou see the ass of him that hateth thee lying under his burden, and wouldest forbear to help him, thou shalt surely help with him. Thou shalt not wrest the judgment of the poor in his cause. Keep thee far from a false matter, and the innocent and the righteous slay thou not, for I will not justify the wicked. And thou shalt take no gift, for the gift blindeth the wise and perverteth the words of the righteous. Also thou shalt not oppress a stranger, for ye know the heart of a stranger, seeing ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. And 6 years shalt thou sow thy land, and shall gather in the fruits thereof. But the seventh year thou shalt let it rest and lie still, that the poor of thy people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field shall eat. In like manner thou shalt deal with thy vineyard and with thy oliveyard. 6 days shalt thou do thy work, and on the seventh day thou shalt rest, that thine ox and thine ass may rest, and the son of thine handmaid, and the stranger may be refreshed. And in all things that I have said unto you, be circumspect, and make no mention of the name of other gods, neither let it be heard out of thy mouth. 3 times thou shalt keep a feast unto me in the year. Thou shalt keep the feast of unleavened bread. Thou shalt eat unleavened bread 7 days, as I commanded thee, in the time appointed of the month Abib. For in it thou camest out of Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty. And the feast of harvest, the first fruits of thy labors, which thou hast sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering, which is at the end of the year, when thou hast gathered in thy labors out of the field. 3 times in the year all thy males shall appear before the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, neither shalt the fat of my sacrifice remain until the morning. The first of the first fruits of thy land thou shalt bring into the house of the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not see the kid in his mother's milk. Behold, I send an angel before thee to keep thee in the way, and to bring thee into the place which I have prepared. Beware of him, and obey his voice. Provoke him not, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. But if thou shalt indeed obey his voice, and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy unto thine enemies, and an adversary unto thine adversaries. For mine angel shall go before thee, and bring thee in unto the Amorites and the Hittites, and the Perizzites, and the Canaanites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. Thou shalt not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do after their works, but thou shalt utterly overthrow them, and quite break down their images. And ye shall serve the Lord your God, and he shall bless thy bread and thy water, and I will take sickness away from the midst of thee. There shall nothing cast their young, nor be barren in thy land. The number of days of thy days I will fulfill. I will send my fear before thee, and will destroy all the people to to whom thou shalt come, and I will make all thine enemies turn their backs unto thee. And I will send hornets before thee, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite from before thee. I will not drive them out from before thee in 1 year, lest the land become desolate, and the beasts of the field multiply against thee. By little and little I will drive them out from before thee, until thou be increased and inherit the land. And I will set thy bounds from the Red Sea, even unto the sea of the Philistines, and from the desert unto the river. For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and thou shalt drive them out before thee. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in thy land, lest they make thee sin against me. For if thou serve their gods, it will surely be a snare unto thee. May God add His blessing to the reading and hearing of His inerrant, infallible, and inspired Word. In Exodus chapter 23, we continue with the life and the covenant, the life and under God's covenant, the application of the Ten Commandments. And so, first of all, truth-telling is enjoined. Truth-telling. Notice, thou shalt not raise a false report, nor put thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. When it says to put thine hand, simply that means, you know, the lifting of the hand for the taking of an oath. To lift your hand toward heaven. That's why we lift our hand. I don't know if you knew this or not, everybody, children especially. But the reason we lift our hands when we take an oath is we are lifting our hand toward heaven. That is, you know, it's a tacit statement, although it no longer applies. It used to apply in our society that when we put one hand on a Bible and one hand lifted up toward heaven, we swore by the God who is in heaven who wrote the Scriptures. And so those vows, those oaths, were before God. Actually, you know that all vows are acts of religious worship and are taken before God. Right? We take marriage vows and we vow to one another in the marriage vows. But those vows are always taken with an eye toward, these vows are taken in the sight of God, with God helping us, with God's strength, and they are taken in accordance with God's laws. So God is the witness. You remember what Joshua did, right? He was preaching one day and he put a stone on the pulpit. I'm dramatizing a little bit. He put a stone on the pulpit and he said, this stone's going to be a witness of everything I say to you today. Right? Well, that stone there stands for God. So when we raise our hand and put our hand on a Bible to take an oath of truth-telling, what we are saying is, may God support me in telling the truth and convict me where I am not. Right? So the telling of truth, how important is that? How important is telling the truth? Well, I put it to you, it's foundational. That without it, we have no society. If there is no telling of the, and that's why we have no society today, because there's no truth in the land. What do we have? We have people that go to court. And those who go to court and spend the most money on the lawyer, they're the ones that win. Truth is often the first casualty in a court proceeding where people are taking oaths to tell the truth. Oh, we need to be truthful in our relations. How can you tell someone about Jesus Christ if truth is the casualty? How can the gospel go forward? How can you learn about God who is truth itself if there's no truth in the land, if everything that is said comes under skeptical questioning? Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, don't swear, don't take those oaths. No, He's not speaking absolutely there. He's saying if your speech has come to a place where in order for people to trust you, you have to take an oath, something is terribly wrong. How many times have you heard someone say, blah, 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 da, 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 and you give them some sort of an incredulous look? Really? Oh, I swear! How many times do you hear that? Well, it's all over the airwaves, all over the media, all over popular conversation. Why do we do that? Because truth has become a casualty in our land. And yet it is primary. How does God communicate to us? By means of speaking the truth. God's Word is what? Truth, Jesus said. John 17, sanctify them in the truth. Thy Word is truth. How are we ever going to have an impact on this generation if we come under the same sort of scrutiny? You see, I believe this is a plan of our enemy to make speech so untrustworthy. But it must never be so among us. We must be truth tellers. We must love the truth. No matter where it takes us. If it's costly, we go there. If it's difficult, we go there. If it's embarrassing, we go there. If it's convicting, we go there. The truth must trump discomfort. Why do we lie? Because of some discomfort to come. Because of some discomfort. Embarrassment. We're going to be in trouble. We lie to cover our sins. We add sin to sin in so doing, don't we? But we must tell the truth. The truth must trump all discomfort, embarrassment. We must love the truth. Thou shalt not raise a false report. Put not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. It's resting judgment. All right, let's move on. Kindness is then enjoined. Kindness for the estate of our neighbor. Verse 4, if thou meet thine enemy's ox or ass going astray, bring it back to him again. He's your enemy. Well, does that mean his ox or his ass is your enemy? Does it mean you can't be kind to your enemies? Listen, we ought to have the kind of relationship with our opposers, with our enemies, with our opponents, in such a way that we can still sit down with them. We've talked about this before. You know, sometimes in church meetings, presbytery meetings, there's great opposition from one side or another side, and there are strong speeches made on both sides, and while those we moderate such discussions, don't we? That's why we have what we call a moderator. And what the moderator does is he is the recipient of all of the speech. So that two men in presbytery are never allowed to turn to one another and to begin shouting at one another or speaking to one another. That's out of order. If a person wants to speak in support of a particular proposition, he stands and addresses the moderator. And if someone wants to address opposition to that prior statement, he stands and addresses the moderator. And that's how we moderate such disagreements. And that's a good thing. That will teach us much. But the other thing that we need to be able to do is after the presbytery meeting is over, we need to be able to sit across the table from one another and rationally and lovingly discuss our opposition to one another. We need to be kind to our enemies. Even the enemies of the gospel. Peter tells us to let them be ashamed for the way that they treat you, but you ought never to be ashamed for the way you treat them. Thou see the ass of him that hateth thee, lying under his burden. He's fallen over. Lying, you know, you've heard, don't worry about the mule, load the wagon. Well, someone stopped worrying about the mule a little too long here, and he fell down, and he got under the burden. Thou shalt surely help with him. All right, so kindness to our enemies. Kindness to enemies and kindness to those that hate us. Let me tell you, that is not a Western principle. That is a Christian principle. And those nations that still maintain it do so because of their Christian roots. Does Islam preach kindness to enemies? No. Preaches the destruction of their enemies. The subjugation of their enemies. You see, this is a divinely ordained Christian principle. Let's move on. Verse 8, thou shalt take no gift, for the gift blindeth the wise and perverteth the words of the righteous. Now this is in keeping with the Lord's care, superintendence over justice and judgment, proper justice and judgment. Bribes are out of the question. We have a whole industry of bribes in our country. We'd never call it that. You know, you hand somebody a card, what do? I give bribes. Call me when you're ready. Right? We have what we call advocacy groups, lobbyists. Now, such things, such as advocacy and lobbying, can be done without bribes. Of course. Of course it can. There can be the occasional going away somewhere to get to know one another better, to develop a rapport and a trust, to begin to understand. But we have to be sincere in such things. Lobbying, as it is in its worst forms, is tantamount to bribery. Those of you who are in my industry understand. You've seen it. Those of you who are not, you do understand anyway. I'm not saying you can't understand it if you're not in my industry. No, far from it. All right. Move on. Verse 9. Thou shalt not oppress a stranger. Again, love of the enemy, love of those that hate you, and love of the stranger. A thoroughly biblical concept. Anti-nature. Right? It is against our nature to do so. And those religions that are born out of the nature of men also purport some sort of vengeance to be taken against the enemy. All right, so then we begin to talk about the Sabbath day in the next few verses. 6 years shalt thou sow thy land and shall gather in the fruits thereof. The seventh year thou shalt let it rest. Now, part of the reason for letting the land rest was as a sign of the Sabbath day. Part of it was for the good of the land. Now, listen, I want to just debunk a couple of myths. Okay? God did not give us the Sabbath day because our bodies will simply wear out without it. He didn't give the Sabbath land, you know, the Sabbath year to the land because the land would be overgrazed or overworked or overgrown without it. He gave us the Sabbath day so that we would take a day to worship Him. He gave us the Sabbath day because He knew that if He didn't command us to do so, our own natural desires would be to continue building our fortunes on the Sabbath day. So He told us to rest, to get away from our fortunes, and to concentrate and focus on Him. Now, all of the Old Covenant Sabbaths were simply pictures of the great fourth commandment, which is that which speaks of a certain daily Sabbath. But notice that even here in this yearly Sabbath, it is not for the good of the land, it is for the good of kindness, so that the poor of the land may walk freely among your fields on the Sabbath year and harvest what's there. And whatever the poor don't get, that the beasts of the field may come in and graze. All the other years, what are you doing? Get those animals out of here, right? Get those raccoons out of my corn. All the other times in the year, but on the Sabbath year, you know what the Lord said? He's going to make the sixth year and the eighth year double years. so that you won't have to rely on the produce of the seventh year. You're going to give that away. You're going to give that up as a testimony that you worship the Lord one day in seven. And then in verse 12, he moves on to the daily Sabbath, and we must insist. We must insist with our dear brethren that do not observe the Sabbath day, or that observe it to an extent, but still go out to eat, that when you go out to eat, you are doing nothing more than violating what the Lord said here and what He said in the fourth commandment. Notice verse 12, it's very clear. 6 days shalt thou do thy work, and on the seventh day thou shalt rest, that thine ox and thine ass may rest, and the son of thine handmaid, and the stranger may be refreshed. The fourth commandment, we recite it week by week, right? Thou nor thy son nor thy daughter, thy manservant nor thy maidservant. We don't pay people to work on the Sabbath day, and we don't work on the Sabbath day, other than those duties of necessity and mercy. But we certainly don't do them for money on the Sabbath day. Are there any exceptions to that? Well, you might consider the office of the priest to be an exception, which is what the Lord told the Pharisees when they came after Him on the Sabbath day. Well, the priests work, and they're guiltless on the Sabbath, aren't they? Preachers work on the Sabbath day, and they're guiltless. So those might be considered exceptions. They might not be. But thy manservant or thy maidservant, it becomes very clear that we're not to pay people. And so that ancient practice of the Jews where they would hire what they called Sabbath servants to turn light switches on for them and to light the stove for them and to kindle fire for them and things like that. You see, that is simply a ruse and has nothing to do with true Sabbath keeping. It's a legalistic, incremental sort of mentality. All right, so then we're in verse 14, and we're going to talk about the three feasts. Again, not only did the Lord say you're going to worship me one day in seven, and especially when we get to Leviticus 23, we're going to see that. Every seventh day shall be a holy convocation for you. But here, even foreshadowed, He says you're going to keep the weekly Sabbath, and then three times in the year, all your males are going to appear before me. And He says, don't you dare come empty. Don't you dare come without your offerings. Three times in the year. Now, when He says, you shall not appear before the Lord empty, we understand that we owe unto the Lord all that He has required of us. Everything that we receive simply in stewardship, that it is all His. So the three feasts are, the first one is called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Another name for that is Passover. The second is called the Feast of First Fruits. Another name for that is Pentecost, right? And the third is called the Feast of Ingathering. Another name for that is Sukkot or Booths, right? Feast of Booths. So three times in the year the Lord required all of the males to appear before Him in Jerusalem. Again, those tribes were spread far flung across all of the land of Israel. And there are other places in the Pentateuch where we read what we were to do when we came together during those three festivals that took place in Jerusalem. They were times of solemnity, but they were also a time of solemn celebration of the goodness of the Lord. You remember when we get to Deuteronomy, we'll read this, Lord willing, but there was one particular instance where if it was too far to drive your animals, turn your animals into money before you leave. Sell them. When you get to Jerusalem, you take that money and you spend it on whatever your heart desires. And you celebrate before the Lord your God. Okay, so three times in the year. Harvest, first fruits, and unleavened bread. Next then, verse 20, you'll not be alone. You'll never be alone. Behold, I send an angel before thee to keep thee in the way to bring thee into the place which I have prepared. The King James Bible here capitalizes that word angel, as rightly it should, because that angel is none other than the Lord Jesus Christ. You remember that there was one particular day when Joshua was about to go to Jericho, and he looked and there was a man standing outside the camp, and he went out, and the man's visage was terrible. He was a fearsome warrior. And Joshua, you know, identify yourself, friend or foe. It's basically what Joshua said to him. Are you for us or against us? And the angel of the Lord said, I am the angel of the Lord of hosts. And the implication is, the question is not whether you're for us or against us, or I'm for you or against you. The question is whether or not you're on my side. That's the question. Right? It was an awesome scene. And that is the very angel that Moses is speaking of here. You see, this is the angel that went before them, that subdued the kingdoms before them. Moses here is speaking specifically of when they enter into the land. But even in the wilderness wandering, Paul tells us that there was a rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. That water flowed from that rock, that the water of life flowed from that rock, that the angel of the covenant that went before them was that very angel that released them from Egypt by the killing, the slaying of the firstborn of the Egyptians, that He went forth before them into the land of promise, and it was at His hand, not at the Israelites' hand, at His hand, that those seven nations were driven out from before them. I send an angel before thee to keep thee in the way and to bring thee to the place which I have prepared. Look at this. Beware of him. Obey his voice. Provoke him not, for he will not pardon your transgressions. In other words, sin is a big thing to him. My name is in him. He is a divine angel. If thou shalt indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, interesting, then will I be an enemy to thine enemies and an adversary unto thine adversaries. For mine angel shall go before thee and bring thee in unto the Amorites and the Hittites, the Perizzites, Canaanites, Hivites, the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. And then the warning against idolatry. Every time, brothers and sisters, listen to me carefully. As Israelites of old, every time we come into contact with the gods of our age, we must heed the very same warning not to take up their gods as our own. Every time. The gods of our age are not as open, not as obvious. They're more subtle. They don't come to you with a big eye on their forehead. I'm an idol. American or otherwise. Rather, the gods of our age are those which steal at our affections, which steal at our attention, which steal away our strength from serving the Lord our God with our strength, that steal our affections and draw our affections off of the Lord to follow them. Oh, they're very subtle. And yet, just as there were many Israelites deceived in that day, we think of Baal Peor and other times, so the siren songs of the idols of our age continue to sound, and we must heed the very same warnings. Oh, it may not be a statue. It will be a concept, a mental construct. It will be something that we put in place of the Lord our God. All right, so then the Lord promises blessings upon them in verse 26 and following. And we understand that those blessings had to do with the land and were they were a blessed people. And that being a blessed people, they did inherit all of those spiritual benefits that had to do with the dispensation under which they served the Lord. So the Lord granted them the land. He granted them riches. He granted them fruitful fields. He granted them plenteousness in their herds. He granted them to be free from diseases. He gave them all of those physical benefits because they were a church under age and their goal was to inhabit that land. Our goal is much larger. Our purview is much broader than that. Ours is a spiritual inheritance primarily. Does that mean that God will not bless us in the physical realms? Absolutely not. Look around you. We are a people richly blessed in the physical realms. But primarily the blessing that we have is to be rich in faith, full of the Spirit, that our children will be gathered round about us as those who believe in the Lord. Those are the kinds of blessings that the Lord promises His people these days. The Lord has not guaranteed us a life of riches and ease. The Lord has not granted to us such things. He has told us rather that those are perilous things and we must be careful when He grants them to us, and He does, that we must be good stewards of His mercies. And then He tells them the expansiveness of the promise. And that promise extends to all the lands that He promised unto Abraham. From the sea, I'm sorry, let me do it for you. From the Mediterranean Sea over here, to the river Euphrates over here, to way up here in the Northland, to way down here, even south of Egypt, down into the desert down here, and way up top here almost to Armenia. It's a great and expansive inheritance that the Lord granted to Abraham and caused His people to fill it up. And at the end of the book of Joshua, we read that in that day the Lord gave to Joshua and to the children of Israel all the land that He had promised to Abraham. We'll read that in due time, Lord willing. Verse 32, once again, the second time we hear this warning. And so we know what a necessary warning it is. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in thy land, lest they make thee sin against me. For if thou serve their gods, it will surely be a snare unto thee. And so we end then with, we could very well end with the end of 1 John, couldn't we? Chapter 5, the last verse, little children, keep yourselves from idols. Let's stand and continue praising God and hearing from Him in the singing of